I'm Natalie Beaumont.
Nice to meet you, Natalie. And what is your role for today and in the university?
So I'm the Dean of Lincoln International Business School. So I've come along today to support the Departmental Action Day that's taking place.
I think I saw you at the beginning of my year. Probably.
Yes, you probably did. Yes. Yeah, I've done a couple of videos that have gone out to students. Yes. So yeah.
And do you feel nervous about today, or do you feel hopeful?
I feel really hopeful. I think it's fantastic to see such a great turnout of students today. It's really good to see how engaged they are with it. We've got a fantastic lineup of sessions, really showcasing different aspects of support from the university, right from support from the English Language Centre to careers and employability. So yeah, very optimistic and hopeful, I think, about the turnout.
Have you met any of the students beforehand?
I haven't. So I only joined Lincoln in November. So I've been here for 6 months. I don't have really the privilege of teaching as part of my role, although I would like to do some guest sessions on colleagues' lectures in my areas. So I've met some students on events, but it's things like the offer holder days, for example, with our student ambassadors. But I haven't had the opportunity to meet lots of students. So it's great to be here today to be able to do that.
Do you think while you're going to attend any of these events, are you going to also evaluate the way the staff are presenting and, you know, taking some notes in your head about it?
I'm here to support, really, my role today to evaluate things. But, you know, I think as part of all these events, we're always learning from it and thinking about how we can continue to improve them for next time.
And one last question, being the Dean of International Business School, do you have any tips or any advice for people how to connect better with the international students, especially post-grads, because they're here only for a year and the changes, I can say, quite dramatic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so do you mean in terms of staff connecting with international students? I think we really need to think a lot about what we teach and what we deliver to make that really relevant for all our students. So my area is international business. So when I teach, I'm always really mindful about the examples that we use, the cases that we use, that it shouldn't just be about European businesses or North American businesses, which a lot of the textbooks focus on, but that we really need to use global examples in our teaching that are going to connect with international students.
That's great. And one more question, actually, about SUSL's initiative that's going off today. What was your role in it, and if you can tell us something behind the scenes about it?
So I haven't been hugely involved with it, I have to say. Suzelle has been planning this for some time, and she let me know about it when I first joined the institution back in November, that this was an initiative that she wanted to launch. It's something that I'm really supportive of. I think, you know, we all know that we need to consume less.
Yes.
So I think any initiatives that can support that and enable us to reduce and reuse rather than throwing things away, so moves towards circular economy rather than linear economy, that buy, use and throw away, I think it would be hugely welcomed. So I'm really excited that Suzelle's launched this initiative. And although I haven't been hugely involved with it, I'm really keen to support it and hopefully roll it out more widely across the business school in future.
It sounds like a great initiative in my opinion, and also the fact that students, when they move here, they don't always have lots of stuff.
Yeah.
So finding things from other students already here, I think it's a huge help.
Absolutely.
So yeah. Well, thank you for today and for your time.
What I would say is international students are no strangers to University of Lincoln. I've worked in the University of Lincoln since 2016, and every year we have increased numbers of international students who are from different cultural backgrounds, from different linguistic backgrounds. And what I see the students is they are bringing different knowledge, different prior education experience to the bigger group. And every day is a new chapter for all of us. Now, English is not the first language for many international students, and that is not, how to say, is an undeniable fact. However, from the international students' perspective, they see a friendly campus. They see the content is accessible 24/7. They see friendly colleagues who are supporting them. And also through the digital technology adoptions, universities are very open-minded. So students are able to find ways to facilitate their learning through using, for example, Google Translate, or nowadays, you know, obviously with Microsoft, a Copilot is available. Some students will be using that sort of, you know, AI tool to help them in terms of grammatical checking, in terms of, you know, proofreading. However, we do encourage international students to immerse themselves in this kind of English spoken, English, language environment. And reading on a daily basis, accessing research informed literature, credible, reliable sources, interact through question and answers in the seminar sessions with different module leaders, different lecturers, as well as having the peer interaction. So the community for students to learn from each other using English has always been one of the, I would say, the strength from international students to move from point to point, from going from strength to strength in their learning journey. And also, I think, in terms of, you know, the language barrier, it is just a matter of time. Yeah. It's a process. So if any international students are thinking, this is what I'm aiming for, I want a distinction in my degree, and I would like to achieve the best, you know, within the limited time I'm spending at University of Lincoln, then the process, we're encouraging them to make sure that they follow the process. So they literally live in it, using the language, using the way how they, you know, start their learning style to improve and to interact. And overall, I think all of this will be very helpful for any international students going forward, or potentially, you know, if we have potential students coming willing to join or willing to see how the learning experience from the international students' perspective. We have international students who would make recommendations. They're on TikTok, they're on Instagram, they're on Facebook, they're all over the places. And we also have the international student intern who are inclusively involved in different projects to make sure the wider community can benefit from their own learning experience. That's
right. If you know any ways in which you can overpass or overcome the language barrier when it comes to international students and engaging them in the activity within the university.
Yeah, definitely. I think the good thing about University of Lincoln, particularly our department, is basically that many of our colleagues are from different linguistic backgrounds. So many of them are multilingual. So they do understand the pain and they do have empathy towards the international students that they have, that they understand that English, though it's a lingua franca of the language, it not might be their first or second language in that case. So definitely the university, I think, she has already mentioned about all those information that is there. Apart from that, we also direct them to the resources that are there in the university, such as Studiosity, so they can the postgrad international students can use that to improve their English, to get a feedback also. But again, we tend to focus more into this, that this is a continuous process, and don't be hard on yourself, because it takes time to learn a language and it takes time to improve that language with writing skills. And definitely, because we are also international, you know, we have been international students once, we understand the process that we go through, and through, because we have also lived with that process, we have empathy towards them, and that's very essential part for us as an educationist in this regard. Yeah, apart from the help that we do give active help with them. So for instance, I have some students who are from India, so I speak some of the Indic languages. So when they come into one-to-one discussion to me, not in the classroom, but one-to-one discussion, I tend to ask them if they're able to understand English very well. So they do say that they're struggling a bit. So I tend to explain them a few of their concepts in their local language if I know them, just to make them, you know, home a bit. And in doing so, I also make sure that they should not be addicted with that thing for a very long time, because, you know, the whole idea for us to get language in English is English. So that's another thing that we have to continuously put into the habit of our international students. And this is how it's done, actually, from my side. Yeah,
this is great information, because, to be quite honest, I am from the economics department, and I did all my university beforehand in my country in English. But it's so much more different to study in an all English country and everything rather than being able to switch off to your native language. And I have one more question for you and then I'll let you. I'm sorry for keeping you so long. What's different here than in other departments or any everywhere in the university is that you're actually embracing AI and are not forbidding it and saying that it's awful. And I do have the experience of teachers saying that AI is prohibited, we should not even know its name, and it's just bad altogether. So I was really surprised seeing you talk so freely about AI and, to be honest, embracing what it can do. So was this a common decision in the university or was it individual and then the university took it?
I think it's a fair comment and also the observation and also your living experience as well. Because let's be fair about the AI development. Now, when you mentioned this AI, we're specifically probably referring to the generative AI, which was from November 2022, when the OpenAI allowed the open access from the general public to access their ChatGPT 3.5. But obviously, the history of AI, you know, could be traced back to 1960s or even earlier. So in terms of generative AI, the large language model, which obviously is the behind power of this really intelligent artificial intelligence platforms, you will be finding it's quite natural that different views from different directions, taking on different perspectives for whichever the purposes you want to achieve, good ways, bad ways, constructive ways, there will be a lot of things happening at the same time. So I would say, from my perspective, I do find the University of Lincoln is putting all together different committees, different focus groups to look into, not only looking into the potential problems, as in the risks we're facing, as in academic integrity, academic credibility, when you know we see the work potentially could potentially be made with the interaction of AI. But at the same time, AI is here. So it's an undeniable fact that it's staying, and if anything, is going to be developed in a very fast pace. So I think instead of steering away from AI, what we need to look into is in what way we can, how to say, being together in this educational journey. So not only from the academics, how we see using AI to facilitate research, to look into the good practice, to see how businesses are adopting AI, but more importantly, we do have the responsibilities in our on our shoulder to look at the principles of ensuring AI is being used in a most responsible way, because only in that way then the AI interaction can benefit the humankind, rather than, you know, we will be probably helplessly looking for the solutions to target certain issues. So I see that as the part of our responsibilities in anyone works in education. But guess what? We have to co-construct this journey together. Now, in terms of academic integrity, I think it's very important for us to emphasize here that AI tools are available, and Microsoft Office has opened their Copilot, and the University of Lincoln, like many other universities in the higher education sector in the UK, along possibly globally, allowing not only staff members but also students to have the access to Copilot. So I see it as a very effective tool. But then how to use it, how to use it effectively, how to use it to make sure that your work is still, you know, you go through the integral academic research learning process until you see that outcome. So it is undeniable, a very challenging journey. But guess what? You have to try. And you have to constantly remind yourself that my interaction with AI is the way how I want to take the responsibilities of. So what I would like all my students, and this is not excluding any student, so whether home students, international students, undergraduate, postgraduate students, they can actually interact with AI, but are they able to hold professional discussions with us? Will they be able to defend their arguments? Will they be able to construct critical discussions? Will they be able to tell us really interesting research journey using good storytelling, quoting the literature, quoting the researched opinions, quoting the research outcomes, tell us about the process? without actually the AI just constantly standing next to them.
Like a shadow.
Exactly. However, you can learn so much more with AI. So will I not allow my students or stop them using AI? I don't think it's possible. It's impossible nowadays. So why don't we just embrace it? But then be open, be transparent, be, how to say, helping each other to construct this journey. And this is what I tend to use in my utilizing my own sort of pedagogy in interacting with my students since November 2022, right after the ChatGPT was open. Yes, and there's certain projects as well that students can get involved in. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll just I think Shang has pretty much covered many of the aspects of that.
You can.
And I think the good thing about that, but many of us in the department are doing research based on ChatGPT or any other LLM, large language models, and they have published papers. So I'll just give you an example from my own paper that I published with one of the journal. So what I'm trying to say here with that paper is we have to be more cautious in understanding if in case we are using ChatGPT, whether it's telling the truth or not. That's why here the responsibility of our teacher comes into place to make them understand, to make them aware if in case you are using, definitely they might be using if in case. And since now universities have different procedures and different strategies how to use and when not to use, so definitely transparency is one of them, but also to get into the thinking, to get into the thinking pattern by themselves also, to make a conscious decision whether the information that is coming from any of the AI software such as ChatGPT or Copilot is actually true or not, how can they detect the biasness in the information that is coming out of any of the AI software. So that is also very essential to instigate within the student, and that's what I actually also do in my class, that to make sure them to understand that there are biases when they are using the AI, and also the transparency and all those integrity procedures are there, which I think Chang has already explained regarding the university.
I think it's also the fact that in AI everybody says it has no emotions, so it's impartial, but they don't take into account that it's taking information from all over the internet, information given by people that are biased and that have the human factor in it. So yeah, it's probably that as well that you mentioned.
I remember from your presentation that you were talking about emotions, which was quite honestly surprising, because hearing about emotions when talking about a dissertation and choosing a topic, I'm doing a master's in economics, so we don't have that there.
No, it won't be. I'm on the consumer behavior, so consumption isn't really just about rational decision making. It is, and we feel we're being rational, but really it involves a lot of emotion. We call that the affective side in consumer behavior. So we have our language that we use, the affective versus the cognitive side. I think the emotional affective side is developing. We are getting more emotional, maybe like with our phones or fashion, and you need how we are seen by others is ultimately an emotional, it's not really a rational thing.
It's important. And do you think that after the COVID-19 pandemic, when everyone kind of changed and became, at least in my opinion, more emotional, and so many other things surfaced rather than the rational part, is it harder to make an analysis on the consumer behavior?
That's a very good point, because I've been asked to write a proposal for a new book, which is Critical Perspectives on Consumer Behavior, because nobody really knows. So I've done one conference paper in 2021, which was post-pandemic, so it was looking at people wanting brand extensions, but actually we're prepared to pay more for well-being and products, even though we have cost of living crisis. It's a confusing picture. So yes, consumer behavior certainly changed, but I think academia is still catching up with that. So it is an interesting area, but I think there's both the emotional but also the cognitive reality, because of the cost of living, as you studied economics. So that rational side is still there. It's more about the sequence. Is it emotion first and then cognitive? Now, obviously, they're not. So it's exploring that interplay, which is, I work with with one other tutor from Holloway University, and that's something we're trying to look into, but it's difficult.
And one other question is regarding students. What can you do, or how do you do it to overcome the language barrier when trying to talk to them or teach them, or even when talking about emotions, which is even harder, I think.
Yes. Well, I think it's important with overseas students. It depends on who, you know, whether when we say overseas, their ethnic origin. So if it's India, for instance, that's, you know, English is an accepted language. If we're talking, it's still a barrier, maybe a cultural barrier more than the language barrier, because most of their language skills are pretty solid. But it's, you've got to try and connect on a cultural level, maybe giving examples that aren't just sort of what we call global north perspectives or just fully westernized perspectives. So it could be good to sort of be aware of brands that they are familiar with and showing an image of something that they don't expect. So an image, and that is the emotional side, that will cut through any sort of cultural language barrier. So I try not to be too westernized. Obviously we still need to be because that's still very dominant, but mix it with, you know, examples, whether it's brand examples or consumer behavior examples from China or India. And it helps that we have lots of tutors now from the Global South, so Bangladesh, Sri Lanka. But obviously they still want that UK perspective. It's balancing those two things. So I think use of images, use of contextual examples that they understand, rather than maybe so freshening. If you've got a master's module at consumer behavior, that's very different than delivering undergraduate, which will be largely UK, European students. Whereas at master's, you'll get some UK, but you'll be probably dominated by overseas students. So it's good to take that into consideration. Don't overteach, don't over text, yeah? Particularly in marketing and consumer behavior.
Yeah, that's good. I remember in my undergrad, they were telling this all the time not to have the slides full of writing.
Yes, just a few key points, or don't even talk from the slides.
Yeah.
Because they'll have the slides and say, read them in your own time, but listen to me. So sometimes I do have text on slides because students still prefer that. They don't just want three or four bullet points. But I'll say, I'm not going to read through the slide. What the slide is saying is this. So it increases the benefit of coming to the lecture. Because if you send the message that everything's recorded, you have a Panopto, it's on Blackboard, why attend? You attend because the lecturer should be doing something different.
Yeah, and the brain's memory is activated because you're going to see the words and you're going to remember automatically.
Yeah, remember the experience. So really audio and listening to recorded lectures is most optimum for those students who attended the lecture.
Yeah.
If you didn't attend the lecture and you're listening to a recording, it's still very dry.
It's not going to make sense, And one more thing, what I noticed here, rather than in the economics department or other departments, you're actually embracing AI and you're not afraid of it.
No, personally I'm not. And I think the department, maybe because they're more involved in consumer behavior, they're more involved in marketing and communication. So AI is definitely a disruptive technology. I mean, there's no debate about that. But this idea that it can supplant critical thinking, I think, is not something we should be afraid of. I don't believe it. I believe in creativity, and you can use AI, but use it to come up with your own critical thoughts. So we have all our AI detectors and the rest of it. It's important students are aware of that. That for me, the current state of AI, and I've checked it out and I've looked at it, you can spot it. A student could spot it because it's generalized and you can get around that by innovative assessment. So, for instance, it's a traditional form, a very tough form of assessment, is a Viva, like you do with PhD, but I do that for my comms module in final year. Students are very nervous about it, we give them practice, but there's no written work, it is a verbal examination, 15 minutes, it's very intense discussion, it's very clear if you don't understand what you're talking about, and you apply it to a specific scenario. So there's no plagiarism issue, no AI issue, no AI can help you. So I think if you think about your assessment, and if you think about your innovation in assessment, and make your assessment very specific, and you can encourage the use of AI, but explain, this will be spotted, this is just a generic understanding, it can save time. AI can generate images, but can never be as creative as a human being. So we've got to start from that perspective. That's my personal belief. And that's certainly what I've seen, certainly AI for the next 5-10 years. I don't see it as I see it as something we need to be aware of, a threat, but it is largely overhyped, I think, in the media. And I'm familiar with media, I'm familiar with conditioning and biobehaviour, so I still take it seriously, but it's not something I think to be afraid of. They probably said this about other technologies. Now I know it is accelerating, and yeah, we need to understand the wider discussion about how we use AI. But I think in teaching, there's many, many ways to mitigate it.
And to use it creatively.
Creatively. It's only a starting point, really.
Yeah.
Because we want your input. So if you're asking for the students' input, maybe, as you say, in economics, where there are standard theories and it's just hard to explain the theories, they need to look at how we test that knowledge.
Yeah.
Whereas, so AI could probably generate, if you said, please describe the Ricardo effect, it would be good. You really want that in context, though.
Yeah.
How is it opposed to something else, or to give an example? So probably in subjects like economics, which is my first degree, you have to be a bit more thoughtful about what AI can do. Whereas in marketing, it's very much more of a real-world application of theory. It's not as straightforward to rely on AI, but maybe in some of the more traditional knowledge-based disciplines, I can see why they are nervous about that.
They really are. But with the defending of the arguments and thesis, I think it's actually good. I don't think we have this in the economics department, but I remember when I finished my undergrad back home, we had to defend it, and it was...
Is that with the Viva, verbally?
So I finished it in Romania, so it was a bit different. I don't think we had that.
How did you defend it? What methods did you use?
We were in front of a commission. We gave our, they already had our books, our thesis, which is way harder because I wrote 130 pages for that one. And they were asking you questions from the
transcript,
book.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they were asking from the footnotes even. And they were asking, I remember one of the teachers took one of my references. It was from, I don't even know the page from the reference.
Yeah.
And they asked me, what did you talk from? What did you say? And where did you learn from this? And what page can it be found? And it was so hard.
That is ultimately a viva, what we call viva voce in Latin, to a verbal defense.
Yes.
You know, you're telling vocally, explaining your valid position.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's just a Latin term, but that's really, you're doing a form of viva to defend your work, to justify. So AI can't really defend and justify.
Exactly.
To the same, it can provide information and provide a tone of voice, but it can't justify to that level. It's simply because it's drawing on the available information. So.
And it also shows that your work is veridic, so that's even better.
Yeah, valid and original. So if you have, you don't have to be completely original, but just an original slant.
Yes.
So I stress that right at the outset. But obviously I've been, 18 years experience, so you learn over time. I think if you're a new tutor as well, maybe they see things differently. They're younger, they believe in technology, they remember it, maybe they rely on technology more. So I think there's maybe a difference between those older in the profession and those younger in the profession. That needs to be considered as well, how to help in that area. And both can help each other, the use of technology, but also to maybe go back to traditional critical thinking, particularly to university, because it's not supposed to simply be a training organisation. It is supposed to have critical thinking and both sides of an argument, not just repeating arguments, but...
Yeah.
Where are you? Conclusion, yeah?
Well, thank you for your time. So, how do you feel the event went today? And it's still going, but what do you think up until now?
I think it was really successful. Quite a good attendance from students. And it seems that we delivered all of our goals for the event. So we wanted to make students aware of the supporting services that the university offers, from career advice to employability skills, to English language, etc. So that was really good. And then, as you can see, they're still going on with the alumni, which I think shows how important employability skills and any advice from someone that has gone through it is for current students. So I think that that's really good. And then the start of the show was the event for postgraduate students, because they are about to get their dissertation allocation, so for supervisors and topics. So having that opportunity to interact with the staff and having our research interest presented to them, I think was really helpful in order to gain an idea of what it is that they can research on and how to move forward. So I thought it went quite well.
It really did. How did you think of putting all this together?
Well, the Action Day normally was held centrally by the full business school.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this is the first time we run one independently. And what
he
we thought
right.
is,
What we thought about is trying to get value added on that day. So we kind of thought about what would be the things that the students would appreciate the most. For the postgraduate students, it was very clear because they have a deadline soon to hand in their proposals and to get the dissertations. Therefore, that was, you know, that was almost like, don't even think about it, that needs to be there. Then obviously we also wanted to launch at the same time this recycling, not recycling, consumption scheme, circular consumption scheme that we are launching, so reuse to reduce. So that was a really good opportunity as well to, you know, insert that into the student's subconscious mind. And then, of course, the other two were kind of, so what else do we have? I thought alumni would be a really good addition because, you know, they've been there, done that, got the T-shirt, they got graduated. So they come with a wealth of expertise. And for me, it's really important that current students learn how to take advantage of all the opportunities they have here now. Who better to tell them that than a graduate? So that's how roughly we came up with the ideas of what to do on the day. I'm hoping that next year we can perhaps improve in a few things. So we didn't expect such good attendance and we needed a big room and things like that. But, you know, room for improvement.
That's great. And can you tell me more about your initiative with reusing things from other students?
Yeah, so this is not new in higher education. Other universities do it, but it will be the first time that the University of Lincoln, especially the business school, has started such a scheme. The idea is that we reduce A, the amount of waste we produce, and B, the amount of consumption that our students are almost forced to do when they come into the university. And I'm talking mostly about international students. You don't travel from Asia, Africa, or, you know, the American continent with your duvet or your spoons or, you know, any pots and pans. So the idea is students that are leaving the university who no longer have any use for crockery, you know, pots and pans and books and beddings and things like that, they can leave them behind so we can actually clean them up and give them for free to incoming students. So that will reduce the number of things they have to buy upon arrival. But also it will reduce the waste that we as university create. So I think all things going well, in September we will see the first giveaway, the first official giveaway of all donations. We already have got donations from local companies. So Uniform Direct, which is a local company that produces school uniforms, has donated to us 16 boxes of end-of-line products that they wouldn't have any other use for. And as you could see today, this room was full of some of those products. They are no longer here. They're all gone. So exciting, popular, and things that they didn't think they needed. Because the other thing you have to think is, like myself, I come from a really warm country. I wouldn't have the first idea of what I need when I come to this country. So it's really good that we have the cardigans, we have the warm stuff for people from other, you know, other climates.
Especially because when I first moved here, I didn't know you needed ID to buy scissors or knives. And I was at the store and I was trying to buy them and they were like, well, where's your ID? And I was like, at home? And I couldn't, I had to wait two more days to be able to buy knives and scissors. And no one tells you about this type of things. They tell you about the visa. They tell you about, the, I don't know, how to get around the town. But no one tells you about this. And so I think it's really important and good for the students, especially because they save money.
Yes, yes. And we also have volunteer students. So actually, it's almost like a peer-to-peer, you know, network in which one student tells the other, listen, this is happening. And everyone is kind of now thinking, actually, from May this year, we will start accepting donations. So we have got a storage space and we're going to start put everything that is donated to us there. We will have a second intake of donations around September because international students, master students, tend to leave the country around September. And then during Welcome Week, we will have the first giveaway of all of these things. We are, together with the fashion management students, putting together an almost like a visual guide of the layers that you need in this country. Because the assumption is you know what layering up means. It means nothing to me. You know, for me, a t-shirt is enough. So, you know, that idea of what's a base layer, a mid layer, and an outer layer, what kind of waterproof do you need in this country, all of that will be created as a guide. So the students are working on that, and that will be published online. so okay. that everyone has access, you know, international or whatever, they have access to seeing. So that's what I need. And obviously, if we have those available, well, they will go for free.
And do you have not a website, but a page or a yes. section dedicated for this? And where can people find it?
Yeah, so yes, we do have an Adobe website at the moment. It is independent from the university right now, but we are trying to work on a way to integrate it to the regular university website. But yes, it's online. If you just, you know, you have to Google reuse to reduce, and then you will get there. But you know, we have okay. got everywhere now the QR codes for people to be able to access the website directly. And the students are actually working on a communication campaign. So we're going to try to really push it now, between now and the end of May, so that everyone knows this is happening. At the moment, it's only circumscribed to the department, so it will be only for students in marketing, tourism, and languages. However, the idea is that if this is successful, we are going to extend it to the whole of the business school.
Okay. How are you managing to overcome the language barrier when teaching your subjects?
I try and make sure that I don't use any words that are sort of colloquialisms. I try and make sure I keep my tone slow and don't talk too quickly. I check in with everybody every few minutes just to make sure that what I've said has been understood. And I'll go around the room and make sure, particularly in seminars, to make sure that everybody's understanding what I'm saying, what's being asked of them. I make sure I'm available outside of the classroom for people to come and talk to me. And then when it comes to assessments, we make sure that the students do understand that they can use translation services, as long as they make sure that it's noted on their assessment that they've used Google Translate, or they've used any kind of AI in order to help them with the language, then we accept that.
And did it become a challenge teaching internationals after the COVID-19 pandemic, when there some other people stated that there's been a shift in their behavior? So do you find it more of a challenge nowadays rather than before?
I think that there is quite a difference in expectations. So depending on where students come from, there is a noticeable trend in students from one country may behave one way, students from one country may behave another. For instance, when I started, I commented to a colleague that a lot of my Chinese students were very, very quiet, very reluctant to engage during lectures or seminars. And it was pointed out to me that in some parts of China, it's a culture thing where if they feel that they ask a question, they're insulting their lecturer because they've not explained the information correctly. Or if they speak up, they're seen as showing off. So it's very much that they don't like to do that. So it's being aware of different behaviours, different understandings. There are times it's very frustrating. For instance, students from some countries have a different idea about what's acceptable in terms of timekeeping. So they will arrive 20 minutes into a lecture or a seminar and think that's okay. But I think as long as you communicate right from the beginning, this is what my expectations are, this is how I expect you to behave, usually they're okay. It's a global university, so you know, we do have to make sure that we respect other people's cultures and behaviours, but you're learning in it in an English institution, so this is how we do it.
When you started working here, was it easier for you to do this rather than now, or is it easier now because of time? And
I don't think it's any different. I found teaching online quite difficult. Don't get me wrong, it was really convenient. I didn't have to leave the house. But I like feedback. So I'm one of those lecturers that everybody hates because I ask you to talk to me. I think there's nothing worse than standing up at the front of the room and just talking to yourself. You know, I love that engagement, that, you know, the two-way dialogue. And you don't get that online.
Yeah.
So I found that quite difficult. I think post-COVID, I've noticed actually with the domestic students, a real difference. I think there is an expectation, they have more of an expectation that you will do everything for them. Whereas students prior to that were different, and I feel we have to, not baby them, that's the wrong word, but we're having to feed them a lot more to bring on. This year's first years in particular, I've noticed, seemed wholly unprepared to be at university.
And do you have any idea how you can, you as a teacher and you as a cohort of teachers, change that in the long run?
I think it starts way before they get to university. I mean, outside of university, I'm a book publisher and a writer. I'm actually writing a book on how to prepare for university from various perspectives. I think parents need to make their children far more independent. I think teachers need to get them to be more independent in their learning, because when they're coming here, suddenly being told you've got to manage your own time, you've got to, you know what it's like coming into university. If they've not got any preparation from that, there's very little we can do once they hit our doors.